are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, November 22nd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Kiwanis Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday after an incredibly brief week in the news this week. It's Casual Friday. Joining us, writer from The New Republic, Alex Perrine, will be in studio. Also on the program today, yesterday's impeachment testimony sinks a fleet of right-wing conspiracy theories. Meanwhile, Trump's investigation of the investigators, part one, falls flat. Democrats plan a next step of impeachment. Speaking of impeachment, or even better, Bibi Netanyahu charged with bribery and fraud and breach. It pains me as much as the Israeli prosecutor to say those words. I'll feel a little bit better after I say convicted. But Bernie tied for the first in a new poll as Deval Patrick burnishes his popular support cred. Spoiler alert. It doesn't look like anything. Ilhan Omar introduces a $1.2 trillion public housing proposal. And why the corporate talking point that free college is a giveaway to rich kids is a farce. Lastly, the Republican National Committee purchases $100,000 worth of Donald J. Trump Jr.'s book. Triggered. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. We are going a little bit early today. Been a nutty week. Let me just start off by saying that if you have not seen the opening statements of David Holmes and Fiona Hill yesterday in the impeachment hearing, and I would actually also say the questioning from both lawyers, you should go do that. I felt I started watching it yesterday in the morning. And I was like, I'm so tired. I can't do it. I'll just turn it on for a second and see. You know, we just didn't properly anticipate what they would deliver. And it was fascinating on multiple levels. One, just as a pure understanding of how a diplomatic corps works when you're dealing with any given country. I mean, theoretically, this could have been applied to anywhere. I mean, just that type of insight I thought was fascinating, and you got that. David Holmes just did a TikTok of the whole sort of moment when all this started, and you get a sense of just like how the bureaucracy works. And then Fiona Hill's testimony was stunning in the way, I mean, all these are very smart people. And I tend to be rather skeptical of the national security types, of which Fiona Hill is one. She said very explicitly during her testimony, I mean, she came in supposedly as a Russian hawk into the administration, but she was quite explicit as she felt like the most important thing that she could do was to make sure that the United States and Russia, though she doesn't anticipate them being best of buddies, have a constructive working relationship. And part of that also involves, you know, having them not be an ongoing threat to Ukraine. But the way that she dismantled, I mean, by the end, the Republicans were not even asking her questions anymore. They weren't. They couldn't ask either one of these witnesses questions because it wasn't just. They didn't just basically look like make Gordon Sondland and Kurt Volker look like liars. They didn't just enhance the case for the Democrats as to what Donald Trump was up to and that Rudy Giuliani was involved in something there. They didn't just basically humiliate John Bolton for being a coward and monetizing the information that he knows. They also have the added benefit of basically destroying every narrative you would hear on Fox News from now until the 2020 election. And stuff that, like, they were debunking stuff that I just didn't, I couldn't even, I had to go back and sadly educate myself as to what they were talking about, because this is, it was basically like having a debate with Tim Pool. And you know, well, did you know there was, you know, an MP in the Ukrainian parliament who said that they got in and
Ambassador, you're acting like Thanos,
right? Exactly,
not to be a dick.
And these guys, I mean, they're there on the Holmes is there on the ground in Ukraine. Fiona Hill is at the sort of the nexus within the White House with all these conspiracy theories coming through. And just to watch, I obviously have a certain appreciation for rhetoric, and to watch the way, and we're going to play some clips of this just to watch sort of how beautifully, I've never, ever seen a testimony like Fiona Hill, where she had the ability of basically apologizing to the lawyer that was cross-examining her, apologizing to everyone for not having, for being rude in an instance where she did not realize, where she was assuming that Gordon Sondland was actually behaving the way he was supposed to, apologize for being rude. She now in retrospect realizes that Gordon Sondland, she was too rude to Gordon Sondland because she wasn't aware that he was basically involved in a criminal activity. And that explains his actions. And she shouldn't have been so rude. Like she managed to pass so little judgment on their behavior and deliver only facts in a way that I found stunning. And we will get to that in a moment. In the meantime, I want to welcome into the studio. It is always a pleasure to welcome into the studio. Someone who I call the chief correspondent and top writer at the New Republic. I don't know what they decide to call you there, but that's my
title is staff writer, but I will take chief. I'll take chief. Anything.
Chief of staff writer is what
chief
I got.
Staff writer
at the New Republic. And
more and more people are noticing.
Not only do you have because there's basically two stories today is the 2020 primary and the debate, but also who's jumped in and where we're at. Cause we're only less than 3 months out now from the Iowa primary and going into a whole period, you know, the month of December is, you know, largely going to be about the fiscal cliff or not. I don't know. But I think we only have one scheduled debate left before Iowa. You have a piece on that. And you also have one of, honestly, it's like completely in my wheelhouse, a piece about impeachment, but specifically the Johnson impeachment. Mm-hmm. I mean, you show its relevance to today, but also talking about Reconstruction, and it's a period which I've become like increasingly more interested in doing almost all mm-hmm. my reading there. In fact, on Friday we have an interview I did with Martha Jones, who wrote a book about birthright citizenship, which, of course, was a major plank of Reconstruction at that time as a way of making sure that black people had citizenship in this country. But that its origins were actually prior to the Civil War.
Interesting.
Which was interesting. I think probably will be interesting for at least 10 to 8% of the audience. But it'll be there on Friday.
I'm in that 8%.
There you go. Exactly. So those two pieces are here today. So I appreciate that. Yeah. Oh, excuse me, my coffee cup.
Scraping my coffee. Your coffee cup is scraping across the desk.
I'm sorry, my coffee cup. Well, actually, that's apropos because, of course, the biggest story of the week was this one. This is when Congressman Eric Swalwell was on the program. Chris Matthews' program.
Hardball.
Hardball. And this is what happened. This was obviously the biggest story of the week, Fartgate. Let's play this clip now.
Taxpayer dollars to ask the Ukrainians to help them cheat an election. And the complaint that I've heard from Republicans, taxpayer dollars to ask the Ukrainians to help them cheat
it was
an election.
Later, one of the conspiracy theories is that it was... it actually came out of the studio at MSNBC. Then it was a function of a coffee cup, and that's why we couldn't help ourselves but to do that. Yeah, I mean,
so maybe a long chain of events that started with a coffee cup.
It does happen. This is part of the reason why we really don't want to do merch. Here, watch what happens when I pull this up.
Let's get a
crack team.
You got to get someone else to manufacture these cups.
We're going
to
get a different cup.
You got to get a new.
Folks, we're all still exhausted from the other day. We did 14 hours on Wednesday. Oh, and then, like I say, I tried to avoid the hearings yesterday, but I watched them and then I had to go live. And at one point, like, I get a text from Matt, like, are you live right now? Because I'm trying to put the show up. And I'm like, oh, God, I had no idea what time it was. but that's that. And all right. But here is so and we'll get to this. We'll go through. I want to talk about you and I are going to talk about 2020 and then it will roll into your impeachment piece. And we'll get to some clips of impeachment. But one of the things that both Fiona Hill and David Holmes did yesterday was they put a lie to every single data point, if you will. I don't know if you can say they're actually data points about the whole 2016 conspiracy theory that the Ukrainians were involved in interference with the 2016 election. And I don't know that I have ever been more, you know, sort of sold on the story that the intelligence community has been promoting, other than, you know, after hearing this testimony, because you basically have the entire apparatus of the Republican Party, which is promoting this theory, and one person or two people who really don't have a huge vested interest in this. It's just that they're professionals and they deal with this every day. I guess maybe they have Ukraine's interest. Sometimes there's a certain amount of capture, although she, you know, that happens, I think, with the diplomatic corps. But she put them to rest, and we will get to that later. But it threw Donald Trump into a tizzy. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear to me exactly what the Republican conspiracy is, other than the DNC, when they wanted their servers to be examined, they hired this company, CrowdStrike, which does this type of stuff. They examined it. CrowdStrike did a mirror of the server as opposed to, like, I mean, it's a cloud-based server.
Right.
So it's all just, there's no physical.
There's not like a, there's not like a black box.
Yeah. It's not like here's our hard drive.
Thinking of the scene in Zoolander.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not like an external hard drive.
Yeah.
And so they did a mirror of the server and they gave it to the FBI for further examination, for forensic examination. I think one of the, it's a California based company. I'm not advocating that they do their job well or not. I have no idea. Some people criticize them in terms of the way they do their digital forensics and whatnot. So I don't know about that. One of the owners, or I think one of the big investors, I think, is Ukrainian. Mm. I think. But somehow this has morphed into some strange conspiracy theory that involves 2016. And Donald Trump is adamant about it, mm-hmm. even to the point where it freaks out the people on Fox and Friends. You got to watch this. This is pretty amazing. He called into Fox and Friends today because his whole Ukrainian theory fell apart. And he needed to get on Fox and Friends to sell this to these guys. And look at the looks on their faces. It's frozen. It's the same look that you have, like, when, you know, people are going through this. I don't mean to make light of it, but when people, you know, because I have intimate understanding of this, when you're sitting there and you're starting to, you're dealing with a friend or a parent or a grandparent who is starting to, you know, maybe early onset dementia. And I'm not being facetious about this. Like the look of concern on their faces as they look to the call, I think explains everything.
That's a lot of it had to do, they say, with Ukraine.
But Mr. President,
it's very interesting. It's very interesting. They have the server, right, from the DNC, Democratic National Committee.
Who has the server?
Now, the FBI went in and they told him, get out of here. You're not kidding. We're not giving it to you. They gave the server to CrowdStrike or whatever it's called, which is a country, which is a company owned by a very wealthy Ukrainian. And I still want to see that server. You know, the FBI has never gotten that server. That's a big part of this whole thing. Why did they give it to a Ukrainian company?
Are you sure they did that? Are you sure they gave it to Ukraine?
Well, that's what the word is, and that's what I asked actually in my phone call, if you know. Right. I mean, I asked it very point blank because we're looking for corruption. There's tremendous corruption. We're looking for, why should we be giving hundreds of millions of dollars to countries when there's this kind of corruption?
Yeah, there's a lot of like, kill me, going like, Mr. President. And poor Ainsley Earhart, she's looking there like her heart is broken. She's just like, I can't, I feel so bad for him, what they're doing to him. He's losing his mind.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
He's losing his mind.
Yeah.
I mean, if you combine this with the thing that we watched the other day where he goes like, you know, like he starts reading what Sondland said and he was yelling on the phone. And he doesn't realize like he was the one who was yelling.
Yeah,
no,
exactly. Yeah.
It's just, and then here's another.
The whole thing is ridiculous. Everybody knows Mitt Romney did Fast and Furious. By the way, that's what people are saying, Rachel.
They say.
They said it. And you heard that one. Are you sure, Mr. President? Yeah, I'm sure.
That's what the word is.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people say. But look, there's tremendous corruption out there.
I don't feel that much sympathy for Fox and Friends people, but they're
stuck in a sort of extremely bad relationship of like a sort of feedback loop.
Exactly.
Where they're like, they're giving him things and then he's twisting them into something and repeating it back to them. And they have to be like, are you sure?
It's like this just sort of just really perverted, like Escher version of a telephone game where it's just sort of like looping back on itself. Yeah. Here is, here is Trump now just going on and on still about, slagging, Marie Yovanovitch, who, all of the diplomatic corps come in. It's just, what would be amazing is to have like you line up all these diplomats and Trump and they all just get to go down and give a statement and just keep going back and forth. It would be insane.
Yeah.
But here he is still. There's something wrong with that woman who is the ambassador in Ukraine because, mm-hmm. you know, he's got his fingers on the pulse of everything.
This ambassador that, you know, everybody says is so wonderful, she wouldn't hang my picture in the embassy, okay? She's in charge of the embassy. She wouldn't hang it. It took like a year and a half or 2 years for her to get the picture up. She said bad things about me. She wouldn't defend me. And I have the right to change an ambassador. And Rudy didn't say good things, but he wasn't crazy about it. You know, it wasn't like a major topic. But I have the right to change. This was an Obama person. Didn't want to hang my picture in the embassy. It's standard is you put the President of the United States picture in an embassy. This was not an angel, this woman, okay? And there are a lot of things that she did that I didn't like. And we will talk about that at some time.
Okay. Okay.
But I just want to let you know, this was not a baby that we're dealing with.
There was one.
So look at our.
Yeah, they're all just sort
okay.
of like,
yes, Mr. President.
This is
no angel. No angel is no like, angel. Like a not weird, a incredibly weird place to go.
And by no angel, I don't mean that I have like political intelligence on her or that she took a bribe from a gas company. I mean, she wouldn't put up my portrait,
my picture, and she wouldn't defend me.
She wasn't talking about CrowdStrike.
I mean, this is this really honestly feels like one of those situations where if we couldn't laugh about it, we would cry. I mean, we have a mad king.
Yes,
I mean,
yeah.
We're living in an age of the mad king. Yeah. And even the jesters are just looking at it like going like, maybe he'll feel better after Thanksgiving. That's the only thing they're thinking. All right. Well, let me just read through a couple of these ads, and then we will get to your pieces, which were both sort of spot on this week. Support for today's show comes from like these. I'm starting to appreciate more than my kids. Now, I don't want to exaggerate, but support comes from Mova Globes. They turn all on their own, with or without a bass, in any setting, in ambient light. Well, look, these guys I lean on in times like these. Like, I got my two globes here, and I'm supposed to bring one home.
I'm thinking,
hey, maybe if they don't notice.
I do the same thing when I'm in the chair.
It's true.
Maybe you need a third globe.
That's what I thought. What if I had two? I could bring one home. They have over 40 different designs, including world maps, outer space, the Earth from outer space, famous artworks. There's something for everybody. Outer space collection even features graphic provided by NSA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratories. I've learned that now. Complete with planets, moons, asteroid, constellation designs. Great gift for the person who has everything or for the person who doesn't, frankly. You can pair it as it's a home decor, but, I think it's – I heard a story last night about Schultz. I can't remember. The Reagan –
Howard Schultz.
Yeah, Howard Schultz. Not Howard Schultz.
No, George?
George Schultz. George. Yeah. That he would bring his diplomats in and say, you know, show me your country on the globe. And they'd point to like, oh, I'm here in the Congo. And he goes, no, this is your country. The United States.
Wow, what a stand-up guy.
But
that's so cool.
They have globes. They have globes that have like maps from 1790 that show the voyages of Captain James Cook. What was the book from about Australia? Something Shores, something that I read. Fatal Shores, I think it was Cook. If I'm not mistaken, but it doesn't show things like the Antarctica, which apparently these guys didn't realize existed. They have you can see the ecliptic line on that one. They have famous art globes, Van Gogh, Monet. They have a Mars globe, which is super cool. Show your kids, Alex. A really great gift, and this is the time of year to do it, folks. MovaGlobes.com/majority. Use the code majority, get 10% off your purchase. That's MovaGlobes.com/majority. Use the code majority for 10% off your purchase. These are the type of gifts that, you know, your kids are going to have for a long time. It's not, you just give it for your kids, but they're beautiful. I really enjoy them. Also, do you have a dog that's rescued? You don't know what breed it is?
No, I don't.
Okay. I wasn't speaking specifically to you.
But you looked at me. You gave me a look.
You gave me a look. It's true.
There's multiple reasons why you might want a dog DNA test for that dog. One, because it's fun to find out what your the breed of your dog is. But it also can help you prepare for a better quality of life for your dog. The Embark dog DNA test is the best-in-class dog DNA test. Kelly, who's given us two testimonials today, she talks about receiving Edie's results from Embark. Longtime listeners of the show heard a lot about Edie. Maybe more than we wanted to.
Thanks for being the one to say it.
Well, but the fact of the matter is, and we, I got emails from listeners who have dogs that are huge, hugely important to their family. I mean, I think everybody feels that way, but we got one that where the dog was both sort of like a best friend, but also very therapeutic for a member of the family. And Kelly writes that Edie tested clear for all 171 genetic health conditions they screened for. She's not a carrier or at risk for any of the genetic diseases that they have. There's also a full clinical trait report. And most importantly, she says, I can provide the report to her vet, which will give information in terms of what's the best food to eat. And, you know, if Edie had a propensity for any type of disease, as many breeds do, they'd be able to treat that in advance and keep an eye out for it. Really important for dog owners. And Embark's test is worth it. It's the most comprehensive kit on the market. It tests for over 250 breeds, 170 genetic health conditions. Apparently, their competitors get down to about a 12% breed mix detection. Embark's DNA test kit goes down to 5%. The test is going to catch which breed nuances that make your dog so special. Embark has an exclusive offer for our listeners. Go to EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY to save 15% off your dog DNA test kit. That's EmbarkVet.com with the promo code MAJORITY. And lastly, I do not use any beauty products.
Really?
I think that comes across. I think there's some people who think that may not be the case.
Oh, really?
I get a funny story, actually, about getting unmatched on on one of those dating apps when they found out I was a soy boy. But we can talk about that at another time. But Kelly was so excited by this. She loves these products. And this is actually something that I've been talking about, which it really concerns me with my daughter. As you know, everybody has become far more sensitive about cleaning your home with cleaner, safer cleaning products. Same thing with the food that we put in our bodies. Well, Beauty Counter is on a mission to get safer makeup and skincare products and makeup into everyone's hands. People don't understand this. But there's no testing regime.
Yeah, no one's regulating anything.
There's not been a federal law to regulate ingredients used in personal care products since 1938, apparently. Beauty Counter started in 2013 by making some, I would imagine this upset some people in the beauty industry, by shedding light on the need for stronger ingredient regulations. Mm-hmm. Today, it's the leading clean beauty brand, creating innovative and high-performing products that are safer and cleaner than competitors. They have everything from moisturizers and makeup and to cleansers and sunscreen. And again, the U.S. hasn't passed a major federal law to regulate these ingredients in 90 years, 80 years. There are over 1,500 questionable ingredients which are never used in Beauty Counter's formulations. That's their clean promise. Kelly writes that she loves having a simple skincare makeup routine. She tried a lot of different combinations. She says it's easy to ignore the mind-boggling list of ingredients inside the packaging, like formaldehyde or coal tar. And it's literally like the stuff gets absorbed through your skin. She said she thinks it's time to face the fact that slathering benzalkonium chloride on my face is something I should probably stop doing. She says Beauty Counter makes it easier to avoid these ridiculous ingredients while still providing luxury products. I've been using Lotus Glow Cleansing Balm as a combination makeup remover and cleanser, which is a time saver. She says it's really moisturizing too. She used the Overnight Resurfacing Peel, brightens her skin with zero irritation, which is nearly a miracle, she says. And not only is Beauty Counter committed to advancing clean skincare, everything I've used has required a fraction of the amount of product I'm used to, which makes their entire line a bargain. I'm a total convert. Beauty Counter has truly become my one-stop shop for all my skincare products and makeup. She was super excited about this in a way that I don't think I've ever seen her before. If you're new to Beauty Counter, now's that time. Head over to beautycounter.com. BeautyCounter.com. Check out special holiday offers before they're gone. No promo code necessary. Just clean makeup, skincare, and gifts for everyone you love. That's BeautyCounter.com. All right. Just a reminder, folks, your support not only supports this program, but when you become a member, you get the show commercial free. The free show. And so head over to jointhemajorityreport.com right now. All right, let's get to let's start with the 2020 campaign. And then, we'll talk about impeachment in a broad sense. We've done a lot of coverage. I can't emphasize enough to people that you should go and watch, the first hour and a half of yesterday's hearings, maybe 2 hours. That's all it'll take. You can speed it up and
they need like the 1.5 speed.
You do that. And then you've watched it in an hour. And I guarantee you it's fascinating on a multitude of ways. And I think, one of the things that's great about it, too, is I think, even like people like Heard, who's resigning in Texas, it's never going to go away, this notion that there are actually decent Republicans, but it should. Yeah. All right. But let's talk about, you had two pieces this week. The first was addressing what is a mystery to me, although I have an alternate theory. In addition
all right.
To
I would
yours.
Love to hear it. Yeah.
I mean, I think yours is there, but you wrote there's only one way that speaking of Deval Patrick and Mike Bloomberg campaigns make sense. Mike Bloomberg has announced officially, I guess, today.
He filed today, right?
Yeah. That he's running. There's a new poll out by Emerson that I think has Biden and Bernie in the lead. I don't know, around 21%, maybe 25%. I don't know where it is. Warren in second. I can't remember where else it goes. I think, is it Buttigieg? I think he's down around 7%. Harris is up there, but no, it's really just a 3-person race. Now Iowa is different and that can change. It's one poll, could be an outlier. If you look at the real clear politics average of the polls, things haven't really changed that much.
Yeah, that's actually like we obsess over who's up and who's down, but like it's been pretty consistent for a few months now, I feel like.
It's true. It's just it depends on what media you listen to as to which polls is pushed at any given point. Mm-hmm. The real clear politics, Joe Biden has 29.8% average.
Yeah.
Sanders has 19.3 average, Warren 18.5, Buttigieg 7.8, Harris 4.0, Yang 2.8, and then Bloomberg with 2.3. And then it's, Gabbard, Klobuchar, Steyer, Booker, Castro, Bennett, Delaney, Bullock, Williamson. Yeah. So let's just start with the idea of what does Deval Patrick – you lay it out in terms of the different camps that these guys come from and who they mean anything to us. So Deval Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts, stepped down. Has he stepped down from Bain?
Yeah.
Bain Capital?
The day he announced, they like deleted him from the website. So it was like, I guess it was like half hour before or something.
Right. So he's just in I would imagine they hit unpublish as opposed to delete in their content management.
Yeah. They moved it to drafts.
Right, exactly. what is he thinking that he can jump into this race at this point?
That's the big question. And so my piece was like trying to come up with the only explanation that made sense. And you like what you were saying about the camps is like, you broadly have Team Clinton, and you sort of have Team Obama, and there's a little bit of overlap, but they're sort of separate wings of the Democratic establishment to a large degree. And Team Clinton, I think, seems largely okay with the field as it is, but specifically a lot of them are working for or supporting Kamala Harris, and maybe they're a little disappointed she's not doing that well, but I don't think that they are necessarily opposed to Elizabeth Warren. Who they hate is Sanders. That's who they really don't want to win this. The Obama camp, on the other hand, I feel like the veterans of that administration and his campaigns are not actually worried about Sanders, even though perhaps they should be.
Right.
But they don't really take him that seriously. I think in large part because of her history with Obama's administration, they really don't want Warren to get the nomination. And you can say everyone would be okay with Joe Biden, but they're looking at his performance and they're getting worried. Like they're like I think like the reason people are entering the race this late is an expression of like concern about the Biden campaign's viability.
Right.
So Patrick, like he's always one of the Obama people's closest allies. And
like, in fact, I mean, if people go back, Deval Patrick, who is it? Axelrod worked for Patrick Firk.
Yeah, that's right.
In 2006, and, governor yeah. race in Massachusetts.
Yeah. And many people feel that Deval Patrick, I don't think this was the agenda why he ran, but basically became the template for Obama's national run.
Yeah, right. And I think that's correct. Yeah. And
they said that.
I think they see themselves as very similar politicians with a very similar message and a very similar sort of potential for in terms of like the sort of coalition they would build. And, you know, you look at like the people like were talking to Politico. This is like last year and a few months ago. People were like, we really want Patrick to run. Like, we think Patrick would be a great candidate. And all of that might be true or might not be, but it still does not make logical sense that he would jump in now when... Steve Kornacki pointed this out. Like, no one in modern history has gotten in the race this late and won a single primary. Like, he has not been fundraising. He has not built a staff. It makes no sense.
He doesn't even have an email list.
Right.
I probably have the same size email list as he has.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think to a certain extent, this also gives you insight as to why Elizabeth Warren some time ago may have floated his name as
yes,
some type
we
of peace
we talked
offering.
About that. Yeah, yes, exactly.
As a peace offering to the Obama people, like, you know, and I don't think enough is people sort of extrapolate from Deval Patrick to Barack Obama. But I think there could be there's value in going the other way, too. If you want to understand why Barack Obama was so willing to listen to Robert Rubin, just look at where Deval Patrick ends up.
Yeah.
But I mean, in terms of their being simpatico. But OK, so the idea is Deval Patrick is in there as just a way of knocking Elizabeth Warren out of the box.
Yeah, that's what some people have said. And I think that there is obviously that I think that there's partial truth to the idea that they wanted to get a Massachusetts poll in there to like harm her chances. Probably in Massachusetts Super Tuesday, or I don't know when Massachusetts votes, but probably to harm her chances there. But then like in New England generally. So like someone else who's a New Englander will like, you know, with name recognition will harm her chances in the polls there. I think that that's probably part of the plan.
I mean, my theory has been that if he goes up to New Hampshire, he cuts into to Warren and maybe Sanders to some extent. Not so much that they would lose, but enough that it would keep Joe Biden from losing so badly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
because
yeah, yeah.
if they each get 25 points
yeah.
and Joe Biden gets 10 points, that's a big loss for him. And that hurts him in South Carolina.
Right.
But if they both get 17
yeah.
and Joe gets 11 or 12,
then suddenly it's
Deval's got like 7 or 8 and Buttigieg has got his 7 or 8, then it looks, the race looks flatter.
Yeah.
And but I have another theory about Deval Patrick.
And what is that?
And I don't think it's mutually exclusive, actually. I think that there's also some argument that maybe he is running to be vice president. I mean, you couldn't look at that debate, and apparently only about 6 million people did the other night, which is less than half the CNN debate from a month ago. Yeah. Okay, there were 13 million some odd people who watched the CNN debate. There was supposedly 6 million who watched the other night. And I want to talk about that as its own distinct problem. But you couldn't watch that and not think... And I know, like, you know, Bernie's more or less the same age as Joe Biden, maybe even slightly older. But you cannot watch Joe Biden on stage, both physically and the way that he is responding to questions. Some, you know, he had one or two good responses, but the others were like, you know, you're sitting there. I feel like those Fox and Friends people waiting for, you know, for Donald Trump to talk about CrowdStrike. You couldn't help but think, like, does anybody think he's going to make it through 8 years?
Yeah.
And. I think there are people who have concern that he's not going to last, you know, that he's not going to have the vigor he needs for a campaign. But I'm saying, like, literally 8 years, it's very hard for me to imagine that he's going to last 8 years, maybe even 4 years. I'm not saying he's going to die or whatnot. I'm just like, you know, he's going to be on the ball.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I say this as, you know, I have parents this age and then they all, you know, they all report to me, you know, they don't have the same energy and this and that. I got to think that for people who are Biden friendly, or willing to accept Biden if the idea was that we can also get a vice president in there who's going to have increasingly more responsibility.
Yeah.
And perhaps will be, you know, never mind, you know, maybe we have a one term president by design.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it would probably would be catastrophic at this point to actually sort of go like openly admit that. But it would make perfect sense for Biden because he's already running as basically, I'm going to be a caretaker. We're going to return to normal. You won't like. No, like it'll
we're not
going to
do anything.
We're not going to do anything.
We're just going to spend our time.
Everyone's just going to calm down,
cleaning up after the hurricane, essentially.
And so you can see a scenario in which Patrick is just there to be like I'm, you know, Joe's like, I'll serve one term just to, you know, lower the temperature a little bit, and then I got this guy right behind me, and he's like can take care of things after that. Like you can see something like that happen.
I mean, this is, you know, this is the thing. Like people talk about now, Deval Patrick has served as a governor for two terms. You know, as opposed to, let's say, Stacey Abrams, who has, you know, really just been a state legislator. Yeah. People talk about her as VP. People talk about Andrew Gillum, who was a mayor for VP. But they're not serving now. They're not, leaving Bain Capital now.
Yeah.
Running in the presidency is a, if you are want to put yourself into the vice president's, you know, you want to put your hat in the ring. This is the way you do it.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, you know. The problem that he has is he's going down to, was it Morehouse?
Yeah.
He had a thing scheduled at Morehouse the other night, and two people showed up.
Yeah, right.
That's stunning.
Yes.
I mean, it would be stunning for anybody running for president. Yeah. Now, I don't know if he's an alum from Morehouse. I don't think he is. But
he's all Harvard.
But he's going down there as a way of showing that I have black support. And this is the room. He canceled the event.
This is why it's such a strange, like, this is why we have to sort of reach for explanations for this, because you can't, how do you jump into the race now again with no team and then have an event like this?
You know, for
like,
what it's worth, I remember when he ran.
I feel like Dave Rubin could draw more at Morehouse.
Well, of course. Yeah. Most of which would be students But when Deval ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2006, he started, and it's different because he started in single digits, and he was running against like statewide polls, and he was in the Clinton Civil Rights Division. So he had a bio, and he certainly had a huge corporate fundraising network from Texaco and Coke and Harvard. But I mean, I think you're basically right, but his track record does go back, and I bet he'll start using it. I ran for governor of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
No one knew who I was. I was running to be the first African-American governor of the state. I polled at under 5%, and within a couple of months, he took off.
I think this is the thing.
He has some confidence built, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, a lot
of deservedly so.
Well, I think, like, we look at it from people who are not people who have run for office before, but if you have run and won, you say to yourself, I can do this.
Right.
I did it before. And I don't necessarily think that means he's correct.
Right.
Well, he's correct. But I think that he can exceed this.
That he can do better than that.
Yes. You know what I mean? He will.
Expectations are so low.
I think it's basically setting up to be picked as a VP by somebody.
Yeah.
And maybe he's getting set up to be picked by a VP by Warren.
Yeah.
I mean, two Massachusetts Democrats.
Or even
Democrats,
if it's like you gotta make peace with me and my wing, or else we're gonna run against you.
I mean, it could also be like, look, I'm gonna get far enough away from Bain Capital that I could be a viable pick. I don't know. This is all speculation, but again, you're right. Like, it begs speculation.
Yeah.
And
there's something into what you were saying about how the influence with Obama and Patrick goes both ways. But there's, like, I really feel like this is my thing with Obama lately, is that he and people like Axelrod sort of forgot the mood of the country and the context in which they won and why they won. And it's like, Patrick, like, you don't go spend years working for Bain. Like, these people forgot how they won 2012. Like, it's,
but
not,
they also forgot how Hillary Clinton, we said it a dozen different times, but if there's anybody out there who, in the sound of my voice, who thinks it was helpful to her to defend her speaking in front of these. Maybe it was overblown. Maybe it wasn't. But I'm sorry, if you're a politician and you're aware that we've just gone through the greatest financial crisis of basically 90% of the electorate's lifetime because of the banks.
Yeah.
Because of Goldman Sachs.
Yes.
It's a problem for you to continue to want to do these talks.
Yes.
And they did. I mean, we know that. We know that for a fact that you know, like, she didn't want, on the day she was going to announce, Bill Clinton was going to go talk to JP Morgan Chase. And she was like, she was roadblocking the campaign from asking him not to do it.
Why not?
I mean, that's a tin ear. And I think that's what you're getting to in terms of the Obama people.
Yeah. And I think, like, it really just speaks to not having internalized these sort of, I would think, obvious lessons from the Clinton campaign, where it's like, not just like, you don't have to be Bernie Sanders. You just can't be Mitt Romney.
But do you think, though, that the limits of their politics are such that, because what Deval Patrick will say, and if you look at his initial round with Texaco and Coke, it's horrible. And he was, I think, was Ameriquest he was on the board of. But in all of his positions, when he initially got hired by Texaco, it was because they had major civil rights case that I think he had actually helped work against them in the Clinton administration.
Yeah.
At Bain, and I heard him interviewed on Axelrod over a year ago, he was in the corporate social responsibility division. So the point being is that in all these roles, he wasn't Mitt Romney. He was making Texaco to be a civil rights company.
I mean,
and he was doing socially responsible investment. And I think the people in Obama world, that's their vision of social justice.
Right.
They're boardroom liberals.
Right. Right.
And I think that is what he will try to sell people, but they might think that will work, but
it's not going to work. Right. But I think that's the thinking.
But again, I think it's also really, it's impossible for me to imagine he's working on anything other than being VP.
Yeah.
And maybe in being a stalking horse in certain situations.
Yeah.
Mike Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Like, I can understand how Mike Bloomberg was convinced to go in.
Yeah.
Like, yes, nobody's come in this late in the game, but you're a billionaire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
also, like,
Mayor Pete? Who's Mayor Pete?
And also, this is your last chance.
Right.
Like,
and to his credit, though.
This is what he's been, I think, sorry to step on you, but yeah, he's been spending money in the way where you're like, if you had said to Michael Bloomberg, instead of running for president, you should spend money to defeat Trump. And he just said, I will do both.
Exactly. He said, one of the nice things about having so many billions of dollars is that I don't have to choose.
Yeah.
I can do everything. Right. Like, everything that you look at Tom Steyer and say, dude, that $50 million, because he's dumping like $20 million into voter registration.
Yeah.
He announced like 2 days ago.
That's
huge.
That is.
That's huge. I mean, somebody's got to pay for it. And, you know, I mean, voter registration is one of those things where there's not a lot of, you know, subjectivity involved.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, he's not going like, I want this targeted only to people who are millionaires.
Yes.
campaign.
Yeah.
Voter registration is voter registration. It's not like, you know, education, which I, you know, obviously highly problematic,
right,
or, you know, housing initiatives or whatnot. It's not public policy. It is just simply pure civics and process, which I think is actually probably the best place for money to go into.
Yeah.
If you're a politician. And so he's just running just to, I also think that he's also trying to be in there to see what happens.
Yeah. Like,
there's so little cost associated with him for him to do this. He's probably bored.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do like this is the part of the mindset where as I just said, it's hard for me to get into it, but all these people think like, you know, I've done it before. Like, I have the ability. And again, like, they're Mayor Pete, like, what the hell's he doing? Like, I could be up there, but yeah, like, last chance. He's getting up there in years. He's probably not, won't be able to do this, you know, a few years down the line. He's always wanted to be president. This is like, that's right. Just a thing. Like, he, you know, dating back years, if you interview him in 2001 or something, he's like, you know, it's either the best jobs in the world or like mayor of New York and the president. And I forget what the third one was, but it's like this thing he's always wanted to do.
Yep.
He's got the money. He's going to try it.
Right. All right, let's briefly talk about the state of the race, and particularly, like, Is Tom Perez still head of the DNC?
Yeah.
Or is he's like in the witness protection program?
I don't
Chuck
know.
Schumer.
Yeah.
Is he and Chuck Schumer, have they been at like St. Bart's for the past like 6 months?
Who's to say? Yeah.
They don't seem to be doing anything.
No.
And maybe behind the scenes, they're really working up something like how can we do another continuing resolution to take the heat off the Republicans in their job to. I mean, it's just amazing. If you're worried about coming off as not doing your job, there's another solution other than passing a despised president's agenda.
Yeah.
That could be prevent the Republicans from doing their job.
Yes.
And make it about, like, that's the thing that Democrats don't ever seem to understand, is that, like, they can play offense in this way.
Yeah.
By basically rope-a-doping on some level.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Republicans are the protagonists of the news to them, so they can only be, like, reactive to it in this weird way. Like, I don't know. It's really hard for me to get. I mean, it's not hard for me to get into Schumer's mindset because you just remember the Baileys, like literally,
right.
Who are like an elderly Republican couple on Long Island. And so from that point of view, you're baffled as to what to do about Trump.
Right, right.
You just don't even really know.
Right. And you just, the best thing, like, you don't need to hear from me until Election Day.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I'm going to come by. I'm going to bring you a muffin basket.
Yeah.
That's it. Six million people watched the debate. Now, I imagine part of that is people were fried because
there's been like so much.
I mean,
news.
Everybody's been watching. There's so much news. And if you are a Democratic partisan, the likelihood that you have been tuning in and following impeachment is probably pretty high.
Yeah.
And you may not have the same. You may not just have the energy to watch the debate. The other thing is that. There was some new questions that were asked. There were some questions that were ridiculous. We went over this before, but at one point you can't get past the sort of like elevator pitch when there's 10 people are on the stage.
Yeah.
And it's like, we've all heard the elevator pitch.
Yeah.
Everybody's heard the broad strokes. Let's have five people up there and have them argue for their visions rather than just sort of giving us a survey course of what their visions are.
Yeah. And because we're also, there are so many people polling low that, like, so many of the candidates are still in introduce yourself mode, which is, you know, we've been at this for a little while.
Well, that's the interesting sort of dynamic, and that's why a lot of these people hang around, because the fact of the matter is they've been introducing themselves to no one.
Yeah.
Because a huge percentage of even the Democratic primary electorate does not seem to be too keyed in. I think the attitude largely is, and this is not surprising to me, having gone through, you know, the Reagan era to Bill Clinton, and on some level, the Bush to Barack Obama transition, which is just like, we don't care. We just want to vote against Trump.
Yeah.
And so pick somebody, tell me who it is, what time I'm supposed to show up at the polls. And that's all I'm interested, because I'm sick of this.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of Democratic voters who are like that.
I think that's true. Yeah.
And so, I think it's time. I mean, I got an email because I said this last night on Chris Hayes' program. Like, you know, they were like, Tulsi Gabbard, what's she doing up there? And I'm like, well, yeah, but guys, Tulsi Gabbard's like in the middle of the pack of the people who should not be up there.
Yes.
Right. Like, I'm no Tulsi Gabbard fan, but, you know, Gabbard is a 2.0 and Klobuchar, Steyer, Booker, they're the only other ones who are on stage, are all, you know, 25% lower than her because they're at 1.5.
Yeah.
And I got an email from somebody who's like, last night I saw the appearance, was like, Sam, you got to knock it off. Klobuchar is surging.
Wait, somebody actually said
somebody wrote that to me. And I was like, what?
Really,
what are you like going from like 1.2 to 1.4, which I guess.
Sure.
From a percentage standpoint.
I mean, she was surging in, like, airtime at the debate.
That's true.
I mean, it's not the most important thing, but it's very obvious that they're, like, literally just trying to, the TV is trying to make this happen. Like, TV
Without
is trying to make this happen.
A doubt. I almost got there last night. I said my Klobuchar line in the 59th minute of, I should say the 60th minute of Chris Hayes' program. And I know what happens when you're sitting in a room watching the last minute of the of the program prior. And and I'm quite convinced that that's where a lot of the sort of the I wish Klobuchar could pick it up energy came from. And I almost got to the point where, you know, TV's got to stop force feeding us candidates they want. But just got as far as saying, you know, Klobuchar's got to go. And then this is one other point.
Did you know she took a loan from one of her ex-boyfriends? Had you heard that before?
I thought that was actually a pretty good line.
The first time she used it.
Well,
I mean, it's like
politicians do that all the time.
Yeah.
If you want to,
favorite politician never repeats anything.
Exactly. Bernie Sanders has been working the same script since 1980.
Never. It's always fresh.
What we love about Bernie is that he always gets something new.
Exactly.
It's the dynamism.
It's the Grateful Dead of politicians.
But there's one other thing I think, and this is your assignment for next week, Alex, because I know you're always, writers are constantly running. I would like to know if it's precedented to have someone who is 10 and a half points out in the polling and has been there consistently, 3 months out from Iowa, who's having trouble fundraising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Like, you know, that came up on the show last night. It was like, well, he is 10 points out. And I said, yeah, that cuts against him because he seems to be the fait accompli. Yet he can't raise money from even the worst of sources.
I know.
Like, that's a big, big problem.
Yes,
that's indicative of a big, big problem.
Yeah. That's what's kind of funny is, like, you know, I see analysts or pundits like this is sort of like a Nate Silver line where he's always like, Biden's, you know, he's a front runner. He's got a front runner's lead. Like, everything's pretty much looks like what a front runner would look like. But it's like, behind the scenes, very clearly, the people who are in the know and well-connected are panicking.
Yes.
They're clearly panicking.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I don't think, you know, Bernie Sanders hit 4 million contributors. I would imagine that is an all-time record for in any primary. Yeah. I don't know if it's a record in the general election, but in a primary, I it's impossible for me to imagine. Just technologically, I don't know how you would have done it in the past. But... And I don't know that that's indicative of his electoral strength. I don't think it's a one-to-one relationship.
No,
but without a doubt, the inability to raise money, even from, like, corporate interests, like people whose just job it is to hedge their bets, when you're that far out, that to me is got to be a huge red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why they're panicking, because everybody knows that everybody knows.
Yeah.
All right, let's turn to impeachment. And we'll keep it broad, and then we'll go into the last round of hearings, just because I found it all fascinating. And I know that, like, I don't know if you followed it. I would imagine. Did you watch
it? I didn't watch live. I caught up with it. But yeah.
I think just in terms of just like the the debunking of the right wing talking points in and of itself was just sort of like.
It was educational because, like, I know of the existence of these sort of right wing things, but like, I couldn't summarize them for you.
Absolutely, and that's why it's been for me, like, too. Like, I've had this in the back of my mind, just knowing.
I feel like I could have explained it about as well as Trump explained it on Fox and Friends this morning. CrowdStrike.
People are saying stuff.
People are saying CrowdStrike sent the server to Ukraine.
Yeah.
Can we do a show like that, please? Can we do a whole show like that, please? Tremendous corruption. But a lot of people saying. By the way, she was no angel.
Yes, you're no angel. But all right, you wrote this piece, we'll put a link to this. We'll put a link to your other piece too. But this is this was a piece that you spent some time writing, and
it's in the next print issue of the New Republic.
Okay,
so pick that up in a few weeks.
Pick up the subscribe to it, folks.
Yes.
It's important you support periodicals that support writers like Alex. This is a really thoughtful piece. It, like I mentioned earlier, it's covering, like, I'm increasingly fascinated by Reconstruction.
Yeah.
And in many respects, I've come to understand Reconstruction is like, this may be a little bit sideways, but this is just what happened when I studied in college. The Judaism that I practice today, that Jews practice today, is really from a period, you know, around the birth of Christ, when Jews left Jerusalem and went to Yavne and basically changed the religion from one with priests who, you know, bringing sacrifice in the temple, to one that all became about the Torah and reading. And so we today practice rabbinic Judaism. Most people would say like the founding father of Judaism is Abraham. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it really is rabbinic Judaism that we all practice. It really came from Yavne, which was a couple thousand years later. Mm-hmm. In many respects, our country's founding technically was 1776.
Yeah.
But it really was the laws that came out of Reconstruction, because the 14th Amendment is like the bedrock of every, not every, but the majority of Supreme Court cases that we hear center around.
Is this like the Akil Amar second founding argument?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. This is, you know, the 13th, 14th and 15th amendments that came out of Reconstruction and all of the stuff like public school funding.
Yep. It's wild. Yeah.
I mean, you never hear, they all say, like, people didn't know this, but Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. What people really don't know is that all of the sort of bedrock progressive ideas that we have in our society, now, I don't know if all,
frankly, but a ton of them.
Ton of them in terms of, like, what society is supposed to provide for its citizens comes from that era, comes from Republicans, radical Republicans. Yeah. All right, so with that,
Marx was literally published in one of the main Republican newspapers. Like, that's just truth.
And so people should know, at that time, the vice president did not run on the same ticket as the president.
Right.
So Abraham Lincoln, radical Republican, or Republican, maybe he wasn't a radical. He, you know, a Republican gets elected with a Democrat, Andrew Johnson.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and Johnson was
or he was a Democrat.
And he was. Yeah. He was. He had been a Southern Democrat, but it was literally like there's so much about this that's funny. Like politically, if you sort of follow elections now, because they picked him to balance the ticket,
right?
Because he was a strongly anti-war, poor Southern white conservative. So he was, strongly pro-war, strongly pro the Civil War and against secession. So he was to balance the ticket. So so Lincoln like runs with a guy who he doesn't actually agree with on a ton, just to like for electoral purposes.
And then of course Lincoln gets assassinated. Mm. Johnson becomes the president. He now has a Senate and Congress that is House that is largely at odds with him, and certainly at odds with him in terms of what they want to do with Reconstruction.
Yeah.
So take it from there, because then you dove into sort of the impeachment process and the thinking. He ends up not being convicted in the Senate by one vote, right? So tell us more.
So I do want to say that a lot of this, I've read Barbara Wineapple, a great writer. She has a book, The Impeachers, which like you, I found myself completely fascinated by that era like more and more. And then you read about it and you read like Thaddeus Stevens, who was one of the leading radical Republicans of the time, and you're like, my God, he's so modern. He doesn't seem ancient. His ideas seem so modern.
Yep.
They were trying to create basically a multiracial democracy in, you know, right after the Civil War. And they came damn close to succeeding. So Congress knows that they don't, at first they think Johnson might be on their side, but he just starts basically a campaign to put the pre-Civil War white governments back in charge of all these Southern states. So Congress has a majority of Republicans in part because the Southern states have no representation in Congress right now. The slave states are not being allowed to send people to Congress because their governments had just committed treason. So Johnson just wants to let's just get back to normal. He's the candidate of, I just want to get back to normal. So we're going to have all of them are going to reestablish their governments. And then the radical Republicans in Congress basically like watching him try to do this. It's crazy, too, because they're out of session. It used to, you know, you had to arrive in Congress by rail and by stagecoach back then. They're out of session for months after Lincoln's assassination. And Johnson is just sort of doing whatever he wants without oversight. So when they finally get back in session,
we should also say that Johnson seems to be a bit of a lunatic.
He is a lunatic. Yeah. Right. And he gets crazier later on, too, because what happens is that Congress then passes congressional Reconstruction, which is basically like the president has been trying to forgive all these Confederates and put them back in charge. And Congress is like, all right, no, we're going to keep the military. The military is occupying the former Confederacy. The military will be in charge of these states. The military will force them to write new constitutions that will allow black men to vote. And then and only then will we admit their representatives back to Congress. Then Johnson, who was sort of unstable at the time, people accused him of being a drunk, although I think Wine Apple says he probably just drank about as much as a normal person back then.
Which was quite a bit.
Which was a lot.
Right.
He starts holding what amount to Trumpian rallies. He drags Ulysses S. Grant, who's a war hero and one of America's like favorite people, and who was in the cabinet, and Charles Staunton, the Secretary of War. He drags them with him, and they are in the cabinet, so they sort of have to go with them on this insane tour around the country, where this is where they're not Trumpian rallies, because anyone can just show up to these presidential events and heckle the president. So people were like, we want Grant. You are a bad man. Like, people are just shouting that, like, we want Grant. They're shouting at the president. And he's just getting angrier and angrier. And he starts saying stuff like, you know, all the radical Republicans in Congress are like treasonous. They're against
me.
They're, yeah, exactly.
No angels.
People. They're no angels. And like,
put up my portrait.
You know, he even starts doing the equivalent of, like, you know, people were sending him letters being like, you should lock Thaddeus Stevens up. And he's like, you know what? My people are looking into it, you know.
2 weeks. We'll let you know in 2 weeks.
So he and this sort of like culminates in. Because so Charles Stanton, Secretary of War, was a Lincoln holdover. No radical, like all these people. It's interesting, too, because you have these people who didn't actually particularly associate themselves with the radicals and were maybe even embarrassed by the radicals. But they just felt they had a sense of duty that the radicals were more right than Johnson. Johnson keeps insisting that that his War Department go around Congress and not enforce Reconstruction, basically. And then when Congress sort of notices what's going on, and they pass a law that basically says Johnson cannot fire a cabinet member without Senate approval. And then, you know, this is what leads to the impeachment. So Johnson tries to fire the Secretary of War, and then that's what leads to impeachment. And it has been remembered in history as this very trivial and silly thing, which is sort of the thing that's enraging, that Congress passed this dubiously constitutional law that says the president can't fire someone in his cabinet. He fired someone in his cabinet. Congress impeached him. It failed in the Senate. And it's cast as like sort of small and petty, or even worse, the lost cause people cast it as horrible radicals persecuting a good president or something.
Right.
Like that.
And lost cause is sort of the myth that came up in the wake of the Civil War to sort of justify it romanticized
the Confederacy in the old South.
And that they were, you know, it wasn't about slavery. It was just about, you know, like was a myriad of things. But we don't need to go into that. Just so
but anyway, yeah. So but impeachment is like the impeachment was, you know, on the letter of the law of him firing his Secretary of War. But Thaddeus Stevens added two more articles to it that were basically like cast the entire thing like here's every way he's been lawless, every way he has incited violence. There was mass anti-black violence across the South at the time that Republicans were convinced the president was tacitly approving of.
Huge. Yeah. In
New Orleans.
What was the name of the there was a massive slaughter of like at least 150 black people. And the KKK was resurging at this time.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what the name of it is. The Haymarket or not the I can't remember.
But,
I'm sorry.
And the KKK was treated too. It was the KKK was treated as almost a myth at the time. This was the creation of the KKK and it was out there killing people. And if you said that in Washington, you were like, people were like, it's conspiracy theories, you know, but like that was being said by people who were supporting the birth of the KKK. Right. So anyway, it was
when he supported it, was it the rhetoric or was there actual like material connections between him and those forces?
I don't think that it was mostly with Johnson. It was mostly just the rhetoric. I don't think there's evidence he was materially supporting the KKK.
Well, but he was materially supporting it insofar as he was inhibiting the ability of the radical Republicans for controlling what was going on in the states.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so it was less I'm contributing to it, more like I'm creating a context in which.
Right.
Yeah.
What I meant is, and so not just a
there were other politicians.
A policy one.
I'm forgetting exactly who, but I think like I think one of his lawyers, like, because, you know, he hired very good lawyers to defend himself from impeachment. I think one of his lawyers, like, afterwards went on to become a sort of high up member of the KKK. But so he was surrounded by people who were sort of in favor of this. But yeah, and so impeachment was, again, like, it was sort of what they felt they had to do to stop an out of control president. And then they lost very narrowly in the Senate. And Wineapple argues that in part because of one of the members, one of the senators who actually bribed with a job and jobs for his friends.
And my understanding is that there was also some question as to whether that, I mean, I've heard the reason why, and I hadn't heard the bribery, although that doesn't surprise me at all. But that part of it was also like, there was also a feeling of, we're going to beat him anyway with Grant.
Exactly.
In 6 to 8 months.
Yeah. I mean, it was an election year. That's the other, that's what's like, you get deja vu reading this stuff because they were like, they had been prosecuting the case like in the House and then they brought it to the Senate and then it became a much more sort of lawyerly argument rather than a moral one and much more legalistic. And then the Republicans who were less radical were sort of like, it's an election year. Grant's going to be the next president. Johnson's not going to win. Like, let's just get this over with and move on.
I mean, the answer is probably all of those things led to it. Yeah. Like, you know, it's as Paul Wolfowitz said, it was the one thing we could all agree on. Yeah. And we all had our own reasons for the war.
And then on the way. But then like the lesson there is like with his lame duck power, the last thing Johnson does is issue a blanket pardon for the entire Confederacy, for every Confederate officer, like even up to Jefferson Davis. Just
I think there was one person from the Confederacy who went to jail. Yeah. I can't remember who it was.
And like in the immediate aftermath of the war ending, people expected and demanded that the leaders of the Confederacy be put on trial.
Right.
Like they wanted them punished. And then within just like a few short years, like that's...
Turn the page.
Let's move on.
It's not like we're going to be living with the implications of this what's time is it now? Until Friday, 11 p.m. In 2019.
Yeah.
And so what are the... I mean, the big takeaway was just that one of the takeaways that I took was that you don't look at the specific infraction that they're impeaching him for. You look at the energy behind the impeachment and what is the agenda, because it is a political process. Mm-hmm. And the radical Republicans wanted to get him out of the way because he was dramatically inhibiting the ability to do to reshape America in the way that, you know, certainly from our eyes today, it should have been.
Yep.
And these guys had a lot of foresight, and also they had just defeated these people in war, and that was, you know, that's.
I think that was that. Yeah, I think that was especially like they were especially disheartened because they had just beaten them and expected with Lincoln continuing to be president that they would, you know, not necessarily get everything they wanted, but that.
There would be some material and thoughtful change as opposed to sort of like it being an adversarial, more adversarial process, I guess.
Yeah.
And so the metaphor today is that the Democrats are being far too timid in this. Is that it?
I mean, and I think
like they're just trying to get it over with as if it's like some type of burden as opposed to it is an arrow in the quiver of politics.
Yes.
And certainly the Republicans have used it that way.
Well, yeah.
And there is, you know, the idea, I don't know, you know, there's something about this that like, you know, when the Democrats look back and go like, it hurt Bill Clinton. I mean, or the Republicans.
It hurt the Republicans too.
It's like, you remember the old Batman show where like the structure of the show was always the same. Batman would get captured. The evil villain would try and kill him. Mm. But some fluke, some deus ex machina would stop it, right?
Yeah.
And my attitude was always like, all right, if we have to accept that you need to kill him in a very dramatic fashion that opens the door for potential failure, why not just do it again? Like the chances of like lightning striking twice.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Like this time, just leave the guard in the room.
Right.
And then do the same thing. Yeah. You already have the shark tank.
Right.
You already have the crane to hold them. Right. Like the Democrats, like they don't see that there's a different scenario that happened with Clinton. And and I think, you know, part of it is there's also on the left a certain amount of skepticism about impeachment, which I think is one of the things I liked about your piece was like these radicals knew that impeachment was a vehicle to provide material difference in terms of governing.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was the first, they sort of invented the procedure as they went along. And there was at the time a sort of understanding that it was, I think it was interesting that Johnson was furious that he was being impeached, but he didn't actually consider it illegitimate that he was being impeached. Like, he considered sort of the actions of Congress to be usurping his power in a lot of areas, but it was just sort of taken as a given that Congress had the power to do this to him. That was interesting to me. And then one conclusion I sort of came to when I read some stuff from the 20th century, and especially a little bit of stuff around the time of Nixon, was that one of the lessons of that failure was, I think, incorrect. And I think the lesson was that the Constitution makes it incredibly difficult to remove a president, and so therefore it should be incredibly difficult to remove a president. I think that at the time it was understood that the difficulty was sort of almost an accidental creation of this process, but it was supposed to be much more straightforward if you have a president who is doing crimes all the time.
And it also, it seems like more, it's listening to you, it seems more like in parliamentary systems, just like you have a vote of no confidence. Like, it doesn't necessarily need to be the most melodramatic thing either. It's just like,
I mean,
this isn't working out.
It's supposed to be prosecuted like a crime.
Right.
But
it could be used a little bit more liberally.
Well, it's an argument.
It's an argument.
It's an argument that comes with potential political costs for somebody who brings it, like in any other situation. Yeah. If you're wrong. And I don't know. I find I can understand the and I'm thinking of the left broadly, because I know why the right has a problem with it, because they're doing politics too. But in terms of the left, and I don't mean like the resistance left, I mean like the left that is skeptical of this. It seems to me it's just bizarre, because on some level that's like a process argument.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, well, it's totally ignoring.
Well, when I read your piece, though, as somebody who's maybe a little bit more in that left vein, I think what it occurred to me, and I skimmed it, I'm going to read all of it, but listening to you now, is that if it really is delineated as a political process that doesn't have to be so narrowly defined, and I'm not saying they would do this, but this opens the conversation of like, well, why can't you impeach Donald Trump for having concentration camps, as an example?
Yeah,
you could. You could.
And that would certainly be, you know, I mean, look, well, anybody who would object to that would, you know, clearly just not be in the
I think that's
fact, right.
I would hope that you would. Yeah. Like, yeah. I would say if I have skepticism about the current process, it is that they are
too narrowly tailored.
It's
reluctant to do it.
They are too,
they're too reluctant, and they're too afraid of their own shadow in this respect. There is a whole host of things. And here's the thing. The process that they've set up is set up in that way. Mm. I mean, this investigation that we've seen, and people should be very clear on this. This investigation started September 9th.
Yes.
And it was because specifically over this topic, it's why on September 11th he released the money, because 2 days earlier, the Congress had started to investigate it.
Yes.
And that has not been communicated to people, because there are four other committees that have ongoing investigations that are going to go back to the Judiciary Committee to form the Articles of Impeachment. When they're done here... and I have the committees written here. When they're done here, they're going to send their findings essentially to the Judiciary Committee, and then the Judiciary Committee will have perhaps a little bit more sort of like, I don't know, quasi process things, and will then, you know, draft the Articles of Impeachment based upon this. But there are. The financial services, the foreign affairs oversight and ways and means also have investigations that could look just like this, except for it's about some guy in the IRS, you know, quashing attempts to look at, you know, investigations or emoluments or
I think
Turkey or other stuff.
I think they have. I mean, to me, I know they are investigating this stuff. But to me, it feels a little bit like they looked under, they finally looked under a rock, and they were like, oh, like, what's under here? That's terrible. And they're like, they're in a sea of rocks.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, this, all we need is here. Like, we don't need to look under.
I mean, I'm of two minds on some level, because there is a quality of like, we got Al Capone on tax cheating,
exactly,
and he went down, and that's the material benefit of this argument, which is like, if you agree that it's that, you know, Chicago's safer without Al Capone, or you know shooting people on the streets, you know, you don't say like, well, that tax thing is a little bit.
Are you going to look into the racketeering or the?
Well, I think to would you like me to play devil's advocate for those people for a second? I think what they're saying is that if you know that the tax case against Al Capone is not going to lead to a conviction,
then
and that also some of the accumulation of evidence to get it is going to empower overzealous IRS prosecutors or whatever to go after other people in the same fashion, then it's that's more what the argument is, right? Like, when, as an example, when I think it was Vindman said, and this did cause me concern, when he said the president is undermining U.S. foreign policy, right? And the point with Trump is obviously that he's manipulating it for his own personal interest, and that's why we're here. So there's no debate about that. But that frame is problematic, because ultimately the president generates U.S. foreign policy.
This is the same
argumentation will be used against somebody who actually just tries to change U.S. foreign policy.
This is what was so great about Fiona Hill's testimony.
Yeah.
Is that very moment, and here's a good time to play that clip. And then we'll get back to the broader point.
Yeah.
But Fiona Hill gets up there, and she is explaining a moment where Sundland talked about an argument that they had. This is clip number three. and she is explaining, and for people who are concerned about the ability of a president to do foreign policy as they see fit, which I think is a legitimate problem, right? I mean, because we don't want a situation where, President Omar says that we're no longer going to be engaging in imperialism abroad 20 years from now, we don't want people to come back and go like, she's not following U.S. foreign policy.
And we have no doubt, I just want to say to be really clear, we have no doubt that when she is president and we've changed the Constitution and she's there and we've made it happen, that the people inside, and this is where I am, you know, a pure lefty, like the intelligence services, the military,
there's going to be pushback.
They're going to be pushback.
Not just pushback. But they're going to try to destroy her and everything in the administration.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
But what was so great about Fiona Hill's testimony here is that she, as a national security and diplomatic professional, makes a very clear delineation between what constitutes foreign policy and what does not. And one of the things that I was really impressed about this was that you see how foreign policy is made, and you see, or at least executed, and you see how much rigor there is to maintaining professionalism. Here is Fiona Hill. She was the National Security Council's Russian expert, who also dealt with Ukraine policy because, of course, the relationship between Russia and Ukraine. And she is being questioned by the Republican House counsel, Castor.
Is he bad, or does he just have not much to work with?
He does not have much to work with.
Well, I think you might recall in my deposition on October 14th that I said that, very unfortunately, I had a bit of a blow-up with Ambassador Sundland, and I had a couple of testy encounters with him. One of those was in June 18, when I actually said to him, who put you in charge of Ukraine? And, you know, I'll admit I was a bit rude. And that's when he told me the president, which shut me up. And this other meeting, it was about 15, 20 minutes, exactly as he depicted it was. I was actually, to be honest, angry with him. And, I hate to say it, but often when women show anger, it's not fully appreciated. It's often, you know, pushed onto emotional issues, perhaps, or deflected onto other people. And what I was angry about was that he wasn't coordinating with us. Now, I actually realised, having listened to his deposition, that he was absolutely right, that he wasn't coordinating with us because we weren't doing the same thing that he was doing. So I was upset with him that he wasn't fully telling us about all of the meetings that he was having. And he said to me, but I'm briefing the president. I'm briefing Chief of Staff Mulvaney. I'm briefing Secretary Pompeo, and I've talked to Ambassador Bolton. Who else do I have to deal with? And the point is, we have a robust interagency process that deals with Ukraine. It includes Mr. Holmes. It includes Ambassador Taylor as the chargé in Ukraine. It includes a whole load of other people. But it struck me when yesterday, when you put up on the screen Ambassador Sondland's emails and who was on these emails, and he said, these are the people who need to know, that he was absolutely right. Because he was being involved in a domestic political errand. And we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged. So he was correct, and I had not put my finger on that at the moment, but I was irritated with him and angry with him that he wasn't fully coordinating. And I did say to him, Ambassador Sondland, Gordon, I think this is all going to blow up, and here we are.
And so it's fascinating because she is describing a, you know, the way that foreign policy is both developed based upon the wishes of the president, which is has its own checks and balances built into it, where you hear from people from State Department, people from presumably from intelligence agencies, from the National Security Council, et cetera, et cetera. She was mad at Sondland because he wasn't keeping everybody in the loop. He wasn't being a team player. And then she realized, like, oh, it was wrong for me to get mad at him about not being a team player, because I didn't realize he's on a separate team. he's part of what, you know, Taylor called the irregulars, which Sondland said there was no irregulars, because from Sondland's perspective, like, I'm dealing with all the top people in the government. So and what it turns out is, in some ways, that the people who are actually doing the business of the stated foreign policy of the United States, well, you could agree with it or disagree with it, and I think, you know, there's certainly some room for that. But Congress had appropriated money, and you know, there is a transparent process to what Ukraine foreign policy towards Ukraine is, and how it's executed is a function of all these people coming together. And she very brilliantly basically says, it was my mistake. I was rude. I didn't realize that they had this other secret agenda that Mulvaney, Pompeo, and Bolton were all involved in. So was the president. And they were doing their own thing that was illicit. We were doing the licit thing. Yeah. And I was angry at him because I thought he wasn't doing the licit thing properly. But in fact,
he was just doing a different
illicit thing.
I mean,
I was going to say, forgive me for, I didn't know you were doing crime.
I'm sorry. I didn't, if I had known it was crimes, I think it is important too, because if the fear, the very real fear, is that the blob will push back against a president trying to enact his agenda, like, you know, that's easy to imagine. But like what we're talking about here is like Congress, like this is a something Congress passed and that the administration was
that's
supposed to implement.
That's a crucial distinction.
The administration was just supposed to implement this thing Congress passed. And honestly, you know, like, another thing I was struck by when I was doing research for my piece was like, oh, there should have been impeachment hearings over Iran-Contra. It was
absolutely
like the same damn thing.
Absolutely.
Exact same damn thing. Yep. And it was like, oh, Congress passed this thing, but we have our own. We're going to do our own little crimes over here.
What I don't understand.
Yeah,
about,
I mean, this is
what I just heard. Really quick question, though. What I truly don't understand about Iran-Contra, maybe, and again, I was, you know, not following it at the time, so maybe this just reflects my own reading habits. But why is it that, first of all, it's crazy that nobody was impeached over that one. But it also seems like those committees and John Kerry actually did a way better job of exposing that story to the public.
They made a mistake, I think, in giving – they got hung up in giving North immunity, and they sequenced it wrong. I think
but
was
I'm
a big
just
part
saying
of it.
What's odd is that there are a lot of people, I think, watching these hearings that are not – I mean, maybe her testimony will help, but this is not coming through to people. And Iran-Contra, I think, did go through to
I
a
will
lot
tell
of
you that there's two things.
Yeah.
One is – you have Nancy Pelosi, who's put the brakes on this process throughout. Mm-hmm. And two is, frankly, John Kerry was in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the hearings for Watergate started in the Senate, not in the House, and then went back to the House. And that's when the House started to vote on impeachment proceedings, that's when he resigned. So the sequencing was different. And having hearings in the Senate, this is the difference between having Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer as Senate majority leaders. Because because what you're going to see when Lindsey Graham calls these hearings on Hunter Biden, the gravity of it is going to be greater. Right. Because the senators, you know, are not, are not these podunk, you know, and I think, frankly, the people on the Intelligence Committee are probably the best of the best at this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the Democrats on there are quite good. But frankly, you know, so are the Republicans at what they're doing. But in the Senate, they're all just a little bit sharper, I think. And
prestige.
And prestige. They have more staff and they have, more That's resources. But I mean, again, just not to put it too fine a point on it, Fiona Hill is saying it's as if she works at a bank and everybody has a job to do in terms of getting the money into the safe. And, the manager has to come over and sign the little docket. Yeah. And then Billy has to come over with the bag.
Billy.
And take the, you know, two tellers have to walk with Billy so that they all check each other off. And there's one guy, you know, Kevin, who's the assistant manager, who's like not doing his job. And she's yelling at him. And then she finds out, like, oh, I'm sorry. Kevin was taking the bag and walking out into the manager's office because they're stealing all the money. And I was mad at him because he wasn't being a team player. I didn't realize that he had a slightly different agenda.
Right. No, yeah. He wasn't following the normal protocol, which I realize now why that was.
Exactly. He had very good reason.
About laundering money from the Sinaloa cartel. What's your problem?
Okay. So here is, we played at the top of the show, Donald Trump calling in and asking about CrowdStrike. or telling about CrowdStrike. Here is Daniel Goldman walking Fiona Hill through debunking the CrowdStrike conspiracy theory. They're now saying that, like, you know, we also want to make it clear that this conspiracy theory was created by Manafort and Rudy Giuliani. Mm-hmm. Part of this is a function of trying to make it look like Manafort's conviction for stealing money from Ukraine. In the black ledger, he was like in this basically this accounting book, sort of not too dissimilar from the mob. Like they have the backroom accounting book.
Yeah.
Here's a ledger that shows that that Manafort's got this money. But here's Daniel Goldman walking Fiona Hill through the CrowdStrike conspiracy theory.
Would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it.
Pause it. He's reading the transcript from Trump Zelensky call on July 25th.
So imagine this in a Trump voice.
Yeah.
Would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. So awesome. I guess you have one of your wealthy people, the server. They say Ukraine has it. Now, Dr. Hill, is this a reference to this debunked conspiracy theory about Ukraine interference in the 2016 election that you discussed at the in your opening statement, as well as with Chairman Schiff?
The reference to CrowdStrike and the server, yes, that's correct.
And it is your understanding that there is no basis for these allegations, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, isn't it also true that some of President Trump's most senior advisors had informed him that this theory of Ukraine interference in the 2016 election was false?
That's correct.
So is it your understanding then that President Trump disregarded the advice of his senior officials about this theory and instead listened to Rudy Giuliani's views?
That appears to be the case, yes.
There you go. she also goes on to basically debunk some of the reporting. There's been two basically stories that they have relied on the right wing. One is by Jonathan Solomon, who you know used to work at the AIE. You know, he was Solomon for a long time, right? He's a right wing and his stuff has all been debunked. And again, go through all of the hearing and you will hear about how all this happened. I mean, the TikTok that David Holmes gives up front basically walks you through this. But here is where Fiona Hill is basically saying, you know, where the genesis of this notion that Ukraine was the real interferers, as it were, in the election. And she also does a little bit, I think, in this clip, explaining sort of what the Russian, I guess, aspirations were with their campaign. They didn't think that Donald Trump would win, but they thought they could inhibit I mean, basically, you know, they thought what they could do was to do sort of like what has happened, is just sort of put a cloud over whoever becomes president. And this is clip number five, right? Okay. It's Representative Jim Hines from Connecticut.
When you asked me the questions about it, I did remember the piece. Kenneth Vogel is a very well-known and, you know, as you've pointed out, extremely good journalist. And I'd remembered reading this back in the day in January of 2017, but it had been a long time between then and October. And you gave me a copy, and I went back and read it again, because I think it actually is extraordinarily important. It gets to this issue here. Mr. Vogel points out that the Ukrainian government, again, you know, they wouldn't have done very well at the bookies, picking up the issue I pointed out at the beginning of today, they bet on the wrong horse. They bet on Hillary Clinton winning the election. And so, you know, they were trying to curry favour with the Clinton campaign. It's quite evident in here. And he relates, you know, to some extent, individuals and some Ukrainian officials, like Mr. Avakov, the interior minister, and a number of other people that he names here and that have been named at various points, and talks about how they were trying to collect information, as Ranking Member Nunes said, on Mr. Manafort and on and other people as well. However, I do want to point out that the crux of the article here by Mr. Vogel is he said there was little evidence of a top-down effort by Ukraine. And he makes a distinction between the Russian effort that was personally directed by Russian President Putin and involved the country's military and foreign intelligence services. Now, I don't think that those two things are exactly the same. I also mentioned in my deposition of October 14th that, in fact, many officials from many countries, including Ukraine, bet on the wrong horse. They believed that Secretary Clinton, former Senator Clinton, former First Lady Clinton, was going to win. And many said some pretty disparaging and hurtful things about President Trump. And I can't blame him for feeling aggrieved about them.
Thank you.
And when
except for everything she said. All right, so this is interesting, okay? And one of the things that came out in this in the testimony is that U.S. officials met with Zelensky before he was elected, which I think is common practice. And I think, in fact, I think it's common practice for the most part that all foreign people meet with members of a campaign as it's going. If there's a chance, like, you know, the reason why you had Russian people, I don't know, Turkish people, any people meet with members of the Clinton campaign and meet with members of the Trump campaign before they win, because there's two people running for president. One of them's going to be president. You got to build the relationships. It's like anything else, right? Yeah. And it's just a question of what happens in these meetings is the issue. And what Vogel's piece was outlining was that the Ukrainians thought that Clinton was going to be president. And so there were different members of the Ukrainian government, not all, but just sort of disparate members, who were making connections with Clinton people. They were looking into Manafort because, A, it turns out he was highly criminal, and they wanted to make sure that they weren't going to end up on the wrong side of the U.S. saying, like, you know, how come you're allowing this guy to walk away with millions of dollars, this corrupt guy? And Vogel's piece was sort of like overstated and became the basis.
Yeah.
And it was really just Vogel's piece and Jonathan Solomon's piece.
Yep.
Now, this dynamic about Manafort came back also into play when Devin Nunes was questioning David Holmes about the Black Ledger. Now, the Black Ledger was basically a second accounting books where corrupt Ukrainian officials, because, you know, one thing about this whole hearing was just how corrupt Ukraine was and how they're trying to sort of like this Zelensky guy, who was a former actor, like literally one, not like Ronald Reagan was a former actor, like 30 years ago, I was in Hollywood. He was on a TV show like 2 or 3 years ago.
And he ran for president.
He was playing the character. Exactly. Yeah. It was almost like their version of The West Wing.
Right.
And he was just like sort of like
Amy Poehler.
Exactly. Exactly. But he seems to be committed to, like, I think Amy Poehler would, you know,
robust, committed to, you know, rooting out the rotten elements.
So there's this, Black Ledger, which Paul Manafort, the reason why he's sitting in jail is because of the Black Ledger was used in the investigation. Manafort did receive money from Yanukovych, tens of millions of dollars in income as a result of his Ukraine work. This is from the text of an indictment filed by Robert Mueller. And Manafort pled guilty to, that he laundered funds, these funds, evaded taxes on him, and also served as a lobbyist for this guy without registering. I mean, these are why he's in prison. Right now, he's got 7.5 years of prison. So here is Nunes trying to show how Mr. Holmes, and this guy, again, is another one. Like, it's almost like you look at those 1950s movies about U.S. diplomats. They all seem to be like this. And here's Nunes going after this guy, Holmes, who, again, you know, takes pride in being a nonpartisan diplomat, professional diplomat.
Name some Americans. Now I want to talk a little bit about Ukrainians, Ukrainian government officials.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with Sergei Leshchenko?
Yes.
Have you met with him?
I have.
Okay. He was a journalist, then he was in the parliament. Is he currently in the parliament?
Journalist again.
Journalist again. Are you aware that when he was in the parliament that he had provided information to a Fusion GPS operative named Nellie Orr?
I'm not aware of Nellie Orr. I'm not aware of who he provided information to. I'm aware that as a journalist, he's provided information.
Well, he was in the parliament at the time. This is in the 2016 campaign. He provided widely known as the Black Ledger. Have you ever heard of the Black Ledger?
I have.
And the Black Ledger, is that seen as credible information?
Yes.
The Black Ledger is credible?
Yes.
Pause it. Now, he doesn't want that to be credible. The Black Ledger was basically these off-the-record books that Yanukovych, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, he's the former president of Ukraine, kept in paying people.
Right.
Yes.
The Black Ledger is credible?
Yes.
Bob Mueller did not find it credible. Do you dispute what Bob Mueller's findings were? They didn't use it in the prosecution or in the report.
I'm not aware that Bob Mueller did not find it credible. I think it was evidence in other criminal proceedings. Its credibility was not questioned in those proceedings, but I'm not an expert on that matter.
Yes, that's why Manafort's in jail right now, folks.
Or Leshchenko, as was reported, was to go after a Trump campaign official and undermine Trump's candidacy. Are you aware of that?
If you mean by the release of the Black Ledger, I think Leshchenko's motivation was the same motivation he's always expressed, which is to expose corruption in Ukraine.
Right.
Oh, synergy.
Okay.
See, yeah, right. That's everyone's motivation. Everyone is motivated to expose.
It's all corruption. But that is that. I mean, that is, this is at the heart of this. And I'm sorry, folks, that your brains have to be polluted with this stuff, honestly. I mean, because I've tried to avoid it. But the bottom line is this guy, Leshchenko, exposed this Black Ledger. I don't know if he did it as a member of parliament or as a journalist. And this Black Ledger, and he made it public, it basically exposed these off-the-book payments to people, one of whom happened to be Paul Manafort. And it ended up being used in Paul Manafort's prosecution. But the argument is that he did this at the behest of the Clinton campaign, as opposed to the Clinton campaign saying, like, have you seen this report out of Ukraine that Paul Manafort's name is on this, like, this hidden, like, you know, the idea that there's a big difference in terms of, like, who initiated it and what the purpose was and how official it was and was it programmatic and all of these things. It just so happened that Paul Manafort was a criminal.
Right.
And it just so happened that it was exposed during the time that he was manager of Donald Trump's campaign. And they are mad about that, and they think it's evidence of Ukraine trying to interfere in the election.
Right.
It would be honestly like, you know, I don't know what the analogy is. Like, you're trying to interfere in the re-election of President Nixon because you're reporting this break-in at Watergate.
Yeah. Or like, yeah, right. Like, it's electoral interference for the New York Times to report that Netanyahu has been indicted.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And you can see with Nunes...
Netanyahu said that a couple of minutes ago, right?
He did say that. He literally did.
Okay.
He did. But yeah, you can see Nunes is pissed.
But it's like the limits of... Because, I mean... However smart or not smart these people are individually, this is like they are poisoning their brains with misinformation, and then they come up against like
there may be another explanation for Devin Nunes.
Right? Yeah.
Now, I this is a completely back of the envelope theory, but I think Rudy Giuliani delivered this story to Donald Trump because he had other reasons to not want an ambassador from the United States to be really investigating corruption in Ukraine.
Yes.
Rudy Giuliani was there way before all this stuff starts cropping up about Yovanovitch. Yeah. About, you know, like this effort was like he was in Ukraine months and months and months earlier.
Yeah.
Helping fight corruption.
And, you know, Manafort worked with a lot of different people. And all that said, there's a story now in the Daily Beast that back in the fall of 2018, Devin Nunes sent over a representative from his office to work with Rudy Giuliani and two of his associates, Lev Parnas and Fruman. And now these guys were also, they were trying to get Pete Sessions to be the ambassador to replace Yovanovitch. And Pete Sessions also weirdly got tens of thousands of dollars from these guys in his reelection campaign. It's really strange.
That's odd, you know,
coincidence. But when someone writes the book about this, we'll have them on, folks. I don't know how much more. But Eric Swalwell decides to take a shot at Devin Nunes here. With his questioning, where he raises this piece that came out just, I guess, yesterday morning or 2 days ago. And Devin Nunes apparently was not very happy with this.
And Dr. Hill, you cautioned us on the dangers of members of this community, of this committee, perhaps peddling any Ukrainian conspiracy theories that could benefit Russia. And I want to ask you if you have heard the name Lev Parnas of Ukraine, someone in this investigation who was influencing President Trump and Rudy Giuliani about some of the debunked conspiracy theories you referenced earlier.
I have heard his name, yes.
Are you aware that Mr. Parnas was indicted on October 10 for making foreign contributions to Republicans in U.S. elections?
I am aware of those reports, yes.
Are you aware of yesterday's Daily Beast story reporting the indicted Ukrainian Lev Parnas has been working with ranking member Devin Nunes on Mr. Nunes's overseas investigations?
I am not aware of that.
Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent to put into the record the Daily Beast story. Lev Parnas helped Rep. Devin Nunes' investigations from yesterday. First two paragraphs reading, Lev Parnas, an indicted associate of Rudy Giuliani, helped arrange meetings and calls in Europe for Rep. Devin Nunes in 2018. Parnas' lawyer, Ed McMahon, told the Daily Beast. Nunes' aide, Derek Harvey, participated in the meetings, the lawyer said, which were arranged to help Nunes' investigative work. McMahon didn't specify what those investigations entailed.
Without objection.
Mr. Chairman, you have been falsely accused throughout these proceedings by the ranking member as being a quote-unquote fact witness. Now, if this story is correct, the ranking member may have actually been projecting. And in fact, he may be the fact witness if he is working with indicted individuals around our investigation.
Wow. I want that. Can we get a screen grab of that? I want that to be on my computer and maybe hang that up.
He's not broken that pose since I think Swalwell started talking.
Yeah, he's still sitting there.
I mean, this is the world that we have. I mean, you know, and I think good for Swalwell for playing it that way. There's so much here, honestly, that I think we're never ever going to get to.
No, I know.
And you know, when you hear the totality of these hearings, you start to realize like this is just a huge den of thieves. Mm-hmm. And they are all, it's going both ways. I'm convinced a lot of these guys are using Donald Trump as a way of paving their way for their, you know, corrupt other practices and vice versa. And it really, I think, is quite as simple as that. It is just like we just rarely see it on this scale.
Yeah.
And so I don't know where these impeachment hearings will go to, but you know, I'm quite convinced that you know, our children, when they're our age, will be reading a book about it on their podcast and talking about this is all this stuff. Remember Dad saying something about this shit, but I didn't pay attention.
I didn't realize how crazy this was.
Yeah, exactly. Really insane.
Are you sure they did that? Are you sure they gave it to Ukraine?
Well, that's what they say.
Tremendous.
I love the lawyer reading a transcript of Trump talking is such a great bit.
It's unbelievable.
It's such a great bit.
There's been a bunch of people who have put what Sundland said about the phone call. They put that to music. I think they did a Ramon song from it or something.
It's very Morrissey.
Let's just do this moment of Joe Biden. Then we got to go, folks. I'm sorry. We've got to end the show early today. Now, I don't know. The reporter who posted this from CNN says that this moment came after Joe Biden had said that undocumented immigrants, they need to learn English before they can become citizens in this country. We need to do that. Now, maybe he's not aware that, in fact, it is the case that to become a citizen in this country, you need to learn English. You know, you don't need to be, I think, like... You don't need to be as fluent as Joe Biden is, but you need to learn English and answer a whole series of questions in English and have a civics test and whatnot that I think
we got to ask Joe to take the test.
That would be an interesting exercise. Maybe instead of like a debate, they would just do like, we're going to do an oral, we're going to do moot court.
Actually,
something.
Having all of the candidates submit written answers would be probably way better than these debates.
Or just do it like Jeopardy style, where it's like, you know, Final Jeopardy, like you all have a pen and paper on your thing. Here's the question, and we want you to, now I know folks that when you got to the dais, you were wondering, why do I have this, this whiteboard. Well, it's because you're going to answer these questions and hold it up for everybody simultaneously. That would be awesome.
That would be, Biden's like, do I get Jell-O after this?
Here is Joe Biden responding to someone. And I think like, look, this again is, well, let's play the clip first. He is being asked by a man, Carlos Rojas, who is from the Cosecha movement. I may be mispronouncing that, but they are there. They're protesting the Obama era deportations. And this is the thing that I think is really important. There's a lot of stuff that Donald Trump is doing that is quantitatively worse than what the Obama administration did, but qualitatively is not that different, but maybe extreme enough that you could argue it. But look, there was a problem with deportations under Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, under Obama. Mm-hmm. With the whistleblower stuff, trying to expose the whistleblower. There was a real problem with whistleblowers getting protection under Obama. And the point is that when you have an opportunity like this, when a hated executive is there, right? Like this is the problem with President Obama. It's like people let him do stuff and didn't contemplate what's going to happen if Donald Trump gets elected? But when it's the opposite scenario, the proper reaction, in my estimation, if you really care about these things, is to leverage this moment to get institutional safeguards, to prevent future deportations, to create more protections for whistleblowers. And I think there is actually some Democratic legislation to do that. Mm-hmm. You take the opportunity now when the institutions and the establishment that propagates these things is at their weakest or least popular.
Yeah.
And so this is real. My point being, this is very crucial for activists. Instead of sitting around going like, you know, Donald Trump is horrible with deportations, but so wasn't Obama. So, you know, you can't really judge. No, you judge even harsher.
Yeah.
Because you use this moment
to illustrate and to create more reforms that are going to be durable for the future. Mm-hmm. And rather than, you know, sort of like preen about it. And so this is exactly what they should be doing. They should be going right to Joe Biden saying, we're going to hold you to account because we're going to force these Democratic presidential candidates. If you want our vote, you're going to have to go much further and you're going to have to reconcile with the past. Here it is.
Over those 8 years, there were 3 million people that were deported and separated from their families. Yeah. We had this classification of families.
Well, you should vote for Trump.
Families
you should vote for Trump.
And I'm not. But I want to make sure that immigrant families and people like Sylvia are not afraid. And you have the power as a candidate to actually commit to stop all deportations from day one through executive action. And we want to hear you say that.
I will not stop all deportations if you commit a crime that's a felony.
Not one more deportation!
I got him. I told him already, go vote for Trump.
They shouldn't be deported.
Well, I'm asking you a question. Someone commits murder.
Look, you saw something that you're going to be
deported. I know,
but... I campaigned for it because I had hope and I believe...
Okay. Look...
He's saying he campaigned for Obama because he had hopes for him, and Obama did deport more individuals. Now,
there will be no family separations under my as President of the United States. That's a lie. Let him go.
That's a lie.
That's a lie.
All deportations are
deportations.
All right. Well, we saw. I mean, look, you know, his first response is go vote for Trump.
Yeah, that's.
And that is problematic, in a myriad of ways.
Yeah.
And if he hasn't spent time reconciling with that period, saying, you know, like it is appropriate, I think, to say, like, look, if we have a felon who is a dangerous felon, they've come in this country and they don't their status is undocumented. I think it's hard to say we're not going to deport that person. I also think you could put them, in prison. But if you could also say, like, you know, it's an undue burden on, American taxpayers, I guess. I mean, I understand the reasons why you need to do that. But you need to be able to, your first reaction cannot be vote for Trump.
Right.
First of all, we need to send xenophobia back to where it came from.
That's right.
Secondly,
exactly.
Why don't you vote for Trump? Get out of my face.
I mean, that's just it's a reaction that just says, Why are you doing this? That's your first reaction. Like you're not
in campaign mode.
Isn't that
exactly.
You're not trying to get votes.
You're not trying to get support. Right?
That's been the mainstream Democratic attitude to all too many grassroots.
Well,
activists.
Even Pete Buttigieg.
Pete Buttigieg
would have an answer for that.
No, look at Pete Buttigieg with the woman protesting him in South Bend about the police violence crisis.
That's true. That was pretty similar.
I'm not asking for your vote.
That was pretty similar. Hey,
that's a good point. All right. Well, listen, folks, we're out of time. I got to jump. Alex Perrin, always a pleasure. We're going to link to your both the pieces we talked about today. But folks, we're also going to link. Let's just link directly to TNR so that people can get a subscription. This is a good Christmas gift, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Or Hanukkah,
yeah.
Especially Hanukkah.
New Year's.
Even in a post-Marty Peretz world.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Very important to support writers like Alex. All right, folks. Thanks so much for your time today. Check out TMBS at patreon.com/TMBS. Literary Hangover, also patreon.com/literaryhangover. Both can be found on YouTube. Don't forget, Just Coffee has 30% off in anticipation of Christmas. And also, ladies and gentlemen, as I said earlier, knowing your dog's breed mix can help you provide a better quality of life for the dog. An Embark dog DNA test is the best-in-class dog DNA test. Developed by doctors and veterinarians, Embark tests for over 250 breeds, 170 genetic health conditions. It's the only research-grade dog DNA test on the market. Save 15% on a dog DNA test. Go to EmbarkVet.com. Use promo code MAJORITY. See you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and